papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we talk about ethical decision-making in the newsroom and look at some of the things that are going on in the news media in recent days. And we invite you to join us as some veteran editors dissect what's going on. Here comes the dissection. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now creating the Upstate American on Substack. And I'm here with a couple of other former editors, Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady, and Barbara Lombardo, who was executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record in Troy. How are we doing so far?
So far, so good.
Brought a scalpel.
Ready to dissect.
Couple of cut-ups.
Oh, boy. Here we go. Look, let's get back just for a second before we go off onto other topics. We ended last week's show talking about Scott Pelley, about his removal from 60 Minutes, the most successful journalism program in history. And in the time since then, there's been a remarkable development in which he actually accused CBS News leadership of favoring the Trump administration. He sat down for an interview with Lulu Garcia Navarro of the New York Times and really articulated specifically what it was that he had alluded to previously when he said that there was intrusion by upper management. And I just want to ask you two, because we here in this studio have previously run newsrooms and local news, a very different thing from CBS News. What sort of intrusion by management would you consider inappropriate? Where do you think there is a level where your publisher, as you were running a newsroom, would have been stepping over the line? And where do you think there might be a role for somebody at the helm of a news organization?
Well, definitely telling a producer to make the protesters look more violent than they actually were, or to have them present the fact that the car was moving towards the ICE officer when Renee Good was shot. That's over the line.
Which is what Pelley understood.
Mm-hmm.
The instructions were.
Yes.
Yes, mm-hmm. as he understood. But I have dealt with a publisher who suggests stories, but always with the condition that, you know, just a suggestion, just something for you to consider, and then walk away. I'm okay with that.
Well, there was a couple of examples I can think of. On a positive note, Monty Trammer was my publisher for over a dozen years.
Who used to be on this show?
He was on the show, and a man of great integrity. And his response to advertisers who tried to pressure us was, our news columns are not for sale. And we lost advertising for many years from one of the local companies that was unhappy about something they knew we were going to publish, and the advertiser threatened to pull their ads if we ran it. And his response was, I have no choice then but to run it. That was great. I had a different publisher one time who made me accompany him to the head of the office of the then head of SPAC. SPAC was a huge advertiser for
Saratoga
the paper.
Performing Arts Center. Thank you, yes.
And he was unhappy because we had published a story critical of him and included his salary, which he was unhappy about. So my publisher had me go with him to a meeting with him. I didn't know exactly what was going to transpire. I thought this could be my last meeting as an editor at the paper, as an employee of the paper. He wanted me to promise that person that we wouldn't be publishing anything critical about him.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. That would have been a very awkward situation, right?
And I promised that we would run what we had to run, but we would make sure that the story was fair and that you had an opportunity to comment about anything that was being published.
Yeah.
And I lived to tell that story.
That was over the line.
That was definitely over the line.
And so
I want to have this conversation because I think that many of our listeners probably don't understand where the proper line might be and what is and isn't appropriate in the eyes of those of us who run a news organization.
Can I tell one more boring story?
Oh, man. Yes, you can.
So a different publisher, I had at least 10 over my tenure there, a different publisher, one of the first days on the job as publisher, there was a negative story about the Bon-Ton department store and maybe owing money for overtime or something with the employees. Bonton was a big advertiser, and the story was ready to run on the front page. And he said, do we really have to run that story? Yes. Do we really have to run that story on the front page? Yes. And he did go along with it. We never got along from that first day on, but
yeah,
that was over the line, too. He could have killed it, and then I would be faced with the decision, do I walk away that day?
These are tough moments because a person becomes a publisher in order to make money. You know, that is part of it. But I think that most good publishers recognize that there's a limit to even their ethical behavior and that the drive for the bottom line comes with restraints that have to do with good news judgment. And I think we all have some difficult stories. When I first became in the early 90s, I was the editor of the Record for in Troy for 4 years, and recall a publisher wanting me to just sit in the room with him as he pitched an advertiser. He said, you know, I just want your presence there to suggest what might be at stake.
Over the line.
And I was a
ding, ding, ding.
brand new editor. I'd never seen any such thing before. So I went along with it and realized as I left the office that I had just been used by my publisher inappropriately. Unfortunately, that kind of thing didn't happen to me at the Times Union, but it was a lesson in the fact that sometimes people who run these organizations don't really understand journalism ethics. And what's difficult to grasp, what is important to understand actually about the CBS News controversy here, is that the person running this organization, Barry Weiss, the editor-in-chief of CBS, it comes from a journalism background. She's never been a reporter, never covered a story, but you expect the editor-in-chief to not have any such intrusion into storytelling. You expect that there won't be bending over backwards to make a politician happy. And so I think that's what is of such concern to journalists listening to Scott Pelley tell the story, is that you certainly don't think that your editor is going to be the person to ask you to compromise your ethics.
You know, the best publishers, I think, are those who don't even let the editor know there's pressure from an advertiser. And editors definitely should not let reporters know that there's a publisher screaming in the background. I mean, that really does put a damper on how you approach a story. If you know that there's a, you know, there's subtle in the background, but the best publishers protect us from that. And
well, I never minded my publisher telling me about the pressure he was under just so that I understood it, but I would never let reporters know. And I think that that's fine. And I never minded going in and talking to somebody. You know, at the height of the pre-sex abuse scandal, I was working for a publisher who demanded that I go have lunch with the bishop. You know, we were being denounced from the pulpit every Sunday morning. And so it was literally awkward. But there was nothing you could do about the fact that these were stories. These are valid stories. We weren't going to cut the stories. So I think it's okay to talk. It's okay to listen. But expecting newsrooms to behave in a certain way, I just think it's good for listeners to understand that there are ethical boundaries that thoughtful leaders never cross in asking you to cut your reporting to meet certain expectations.
And I think a lot of people believe that we do cross those things all the time. Oh, you're just doing that story to sell a paper. You're just doing that because they're a big advertiser. No, that's really not the case. You're right. It's a good example of how we operate and the kind of ethics we try to maintain.
I listened to the interview between Scott Pelley and Lulu Navarro, and he got emotional at times. He talked about how he felt the need to speak up at this meeting, which all this got leaked from, because he was the senior member of the of the news staff at that meeting, and so he felt the need to speak up about that. But when he got emotional, how that news was relayed by different news sources, so the New York Post's headline was, Pelley cries over firing, when he did well up a couple of times.
Yeah, it was interesting. Yes, you can always count on the New York Post to distort. Actually, we have a bit of that discussion. I think it's really worth listening to a little bit of what Scott Pelley said.
What do you hope will happen now?
My hope is that the leadership of Paramount will say to themselves, okay, this isn't working. We have respected journalists saying that there is a thumb on the scale for one political party over another. And there's a subtle political bias that I've never seen at 60 Minutes before or at CBS News before. We can save this it's possible to land this plane. But right now, CBS News, in my view, is on fire.
It's an amazing assertion by somebody who's put his career into CBS News for so many years. And we will be looking for what comes next, obviously, out of this. By the way, that's a great baritone, isn't it?
It is. But, you know, just kind of, this may be unpopular, but he does sound naive, doesn't he? And I did not like the photo that accompanied the story of him on a sailboat. It made us seem like the journalists were, you know, I realize he probably makes a lot of money, can afford a great big sailboat, but it just, I wish it had been more pedestrian than it was.
I used to have a sailboat on Saratoga Lake.
Me too.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was nothing like that.
No, it didn't look like that at all. Oh, well, the problem in sailing in Saratoga Lake is, you know,
there's no wind.
And there is the weeds, you know. Yeah. It's terrible.
We digress.
Folks, media@wamc.org. We really appreciate hearing from you. Actually, we heard from Daniel. I don't know where Daniel's from, but he just a cute little note from last week. We were talking last week about the end of CBS Radio News, another part of the demise of that once great institution. And he said, just a quick thanks to Rex for adding the jingle for CBS Radio News. Da-da-da-da-da. Remember that? That was at the top. He said some years ago his head recycled it, but he couldn't place it. And after hearing that rendition, thank you very much, it was enough to remember that it was from my father playing the news on the radio at lunchtime while he was working in the barn. I've given him closure. Very proud.
That's
media
nice.
At WAMC.org. We really appreciate hearing from you. So the other bit of national journalism news that we need to talk about here is the president walking out from an interview with the host of Meet the Press, Kristen Welker, who I believe, if I counted it correctly, 12 times fact-checked the president in a four-minute period as he was talking in the midst of an interview. An interview that at the White House's insistence had been taking place in a barn instead of in a studio, and there was a lot of rain pounding on the metal roof, so it was a challenging environment for an interview in any case. But eventually, the president said that the network was crooked and said, let's call it quits because I've had enough. He walked out of the interview. Have you ever had a politician just refuse to talk to you that way, walk out, to sort of get so frustrated?
He stepped on the microphone on the way out, too. And he called her darling. I hate it. There's so many things to hate about that interview, but I hated when he called her darling and patted her on the shoulder. It's just creepy.
After calling her crooked and stupid, I give her a round of applause for handling this with aplomb, if I'm saying that right. I can spell it, but I can't say it.
We don't have to speak very well.
We're newspaper people.
Yeah. Because she held him to account for his assertions.
You mean? Mm-hmm. She did that, and she didn't lose her cool. She kept saying, let's continue. She didn't fall for his bait.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wish he would do more of these kinds of sit-down interviews. I still remember the Jonathan Swan interview he did. That was a great one. And this was during the first term, and he was not as outrageous as he is now. He's just so used to badgering reporters, and reporters, as we've said, they just keep taking it. Thankfully, Kristen Welker finally stands up and holds him to account in a way the press corps in the White House typically does not.
Right. It requires that the reporters and their staff do homework and are prepared for that. I remember that Jonathan Swan one, and I used it in my class multiple times because he came prepared and he had his statistics. They were talking about COVID, and President Trump had these bogus charts about COVID deaths, and he was able to refute it on the spot, as Kristen Welker was able to do.
You know, remember the Trump administration, or maybe President Trump, sued CBS because they didn't release full details or the full transcript of whatever, and they had to promise that from now on we're going to release the full transcript. In this case, that worked against him, because when you see the full, you know, the stepping on the microphone, the hey darling, you get a sense of how wayward that interview went. you know, the bottom line here is the public really didn't get a lot of valuable information out of that interview.
Well, you're never going to get valuable information out of an interview with the president. You're not going to get answers to the questions you hope for. The information that you get is, how is his mind working today? You know, and that could be value.
I didn't like her pleading, we came all the way to Wisconsin or wherever they, you know, it's like, well, okay, you can fly to Wisconsin. I'm not going to really feel that sorry that you had to travel to interview the president.
Yeah. Why do you think it is that that kind of holding him to account is what is rarely seen? Is it simply because it's impossible for reporters to so effectively prepare for an interview like that? Why? She was really able to hold him to account, to say, to fact check him. I wonder why that isn't the case all the time in press gaggles, in every encounter that he has with mainstream media.
You know, I've read defenses of how the White House press corps is handling this, and they're saying, we don't want to be part of the story. We don't want to be antagonistic. We want to show respect to the president. I think that time has passed, and they tend to write for each other. We see this at the state capitol, where we used to see it at the capitol, where the reporters are writing for each other or writing for their bosses back at the studio, and they're not paying attention to what the people in America really want to hear.
They're looking for their little sound bite. They're looking for their gotcha moment that, you know, it's almost like self-serving ego kind of a thing for themselves and their outlet, if such a thing really exists.
We dare the president to come here. We will interview him.
we will
ask him questions and hold him to account.
The statements are so outrageous and so false that it is hard to come back with. You could argue that that's not true. There's no evidence. But then to actually be able to present the evidence. I did write to the White House Correspondents Association.
You did.
I volunteered to do that, asking them about their position on having their members speak up at the press conferences at the White House when their colleagues are belittled and the questions aren't answered. And so if I hear back from them...
You're asking why there's not a follow-up that demands that the same question be posed by the reporter who's following next.
Right, or stand up for the person, don't belittle my colleague, or that's not appropriate language. Mm-hmm. And so if I hear back from them, then I will open the dialogue and ask this other question next.
Well, we will look forward to hearing back.
You know, they're still going to have that correspondence dinner. It's not going to be a dinner. It's going to be a luncheon with the president in July. I mean, you know, you would think that they would realize that the guy does not like the free press. He does not like them. And no headway is going to be made by having a luncheon with them.
Let's talk about the reality of having to cover somebody day in and day out, and how you've done that as a reporter. You've sent reporters as an editor into the fray. When you are on a beat, when your job of getting information depends upon getting access, how do you maintain access if you're constantly in combat with the person who holds the information?
You have to make a judgment call about what access is actually doing for you. If access is giving you a quote that means nothing, that's not true, is it really valuable? I mean, I know the president is an extreme case, but we do deal with this as a real issue, that if someone won't talk to you, you still need to get that quote. Maybe we don't need quotes that much anymore.
Well, sometimes the answer is that they didn't answer. Or their answer is whatever their answer is, and then as the reporter and editor, you follow that, the next paragraph explaining what reality is about.
And we've talked before in this program about the difficulty of getting through to principals these days. That is, you're frequently facing only a staff aide. You're frequently limited to interactions only by email. And that's really a further removal from access to people who have information. The solution to that, of course, is to dig deeper. I remember when I was a reporter for Newsday, which was then a great newspaper, but it was still second tier compared to CBS News or the New York Times in terms of the hierarchy of who officials respond to. And I remember one of my colleagues who was in the Washington Bureau saying, she actually felt that it was to her advantage because it forced her to look deeper for sources, that when the Assistant Secretary of Defense came back from lunch and saw all the little while you were out notes, who to call back, she said, they're not going to call me. They're going to call CBS News. They're going to call whoever. But she said, therefore,
well, not so much CBS anymore.
Not anymore, yes. But the point was they would go to the more important journalists, and it forced her to get more creative in her sourcing. And I think that's a really interesting element. If you were teaching graduate students in journalism, you'd be saying, or giving advice to reporters in the newsroom, find sources who aren't the expected sources. Go to people who are beneath the level that you would, who, if you can find them.
Yeah, it's more challenging than ever, because even to get into the building, City Hall, which in Saratoga would be just a place where everybody could, but you could wander around and you could stop in people's offices back in the day.
Are you now limited from that?
I don't know what the situation
is. In some city halls.
Yeah. I think you still can go in there. I don't know if the people are
certainly
working there or if they're working remotely.
That's the case in the state capitol. The second floor of the state capitol, which is where the executive chamber exists, used to be open. You could drop into the lieutenant governor's office, go into the press office, and that is, of course, now cut off, allegedly for law enforcement purposes, for security.
But in this digital age, they need a soundbite. They need a person on camera. And if the main person is not going to give the soundbite and not going to go on camera, the reporter is at an impasse. What do they do? They can't, you know, they have a great unnamed source. They can voice it themselves. But to make it really, you know, dazzle online, they need to think a lot more creatively than they did before.
Of course, for the politicians, for the officials who are trying to get their point across, they care less about media anyway, because they're going to be using social media, their own channels. And the way that people get information now is different. I was taken by reading from a newsletter that circulated by Dick Toeffel, who's a former president of Politico and really one of the great thinkers about the future of the media these days. And he quoted in a newsletter a new study published by the Greater Montana Foundation that found that about two-thirds of people in Montana, Montanans they say, were consuming news that was just delivered to them rather than actively sought by them. That is, it's passive delivery. You know, at the gas pump even now, as you're filling your car, you get little headlines and you get little video. You stand in an elevator, there's a presentation for you. 40% of registered voters said news comes to me in this study of 12,000 people, as opposed to I actively seek out the news. And therefore, what I think that suggests is one of the reasons why politicians find it so easy to just blow us off as journalists is because people are getting information from other sources which they can control rather than which journalists have control of as information gatekeepers.
Yes, everybody needs gas.
I guess so. But if citizens aren't paying attention, if they're not worried about getting the news, it makes the role of journalists for news organizations less vital. And to the political figures, they don't need us to get the information out of
them. Well, we need to figure out better of how to get that, that we should be the source that is being foisted on them.
You know, like this idea of passive receipt of news is an interesting one, because you have to wonder, well, does that mean does it only mean at the gas station, or does it mean when I turn the radio on and I'm listening to the opera and then the news comes on at the top of the hour? Does it mean that my Facebook feed is going to deliver the Times Union story on, you know, water problems in a city? I'm not sure exactly what they mean by passive.
Yeah, that it comes to them instead of they're looking for it. And that's, of course, why there's so little in terms of subscriptions.
Yeah, I mean, it could be friends sharing something that they've picked up from
from
credible or non-credible sources.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how active a news reader I am. What do I do to reach out for news? I mean, I click on websites.
Yeah, well, that's it.
Well, and you're listening to opera. Come on.
Right.
Well, that was not a real comment.
Right.
Sorry.
Well, that's why we're in a position of being very grateful to have independent news sources. Here we are in WAMC, which, by the way, just had a successful fun drive. We're very grateful to listeners for that.
Thank you. Lots of opera fans.
Happy to be here. Absolutely. But that's why you need an independent news source that you know is not manipulated by the message senders. And we're grateful to the folks who make that possible. That's all we have time for, as a matter of fact, today. The Media Project for this week has reached its conclusion. Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith, and we appreciate you joining us. And David Gustina is the producer of The Media Project. Thanks for joining us. We hope to come back again next week for The Media Project.
To get a living wage, they joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspaper men are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed...
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.